O God of our many understandings, we pray that you will bless us with tears. Tears for a world in which over a billion people exist on less than a dollar a day, where young women in many lands are beaten and raped for wanting an education, and thousands die daily from malnutrition, malaria, and AIDS. Bless this nation with anger, anger at discrimination at home and abroad, against refugees and immigrants, women, people of color, gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. The voice you just heard is the voice of the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, who's the ninth bishop of the Diocese of New Hampshire in the Episcopal Church of the United States. He gave the invocation at the event that kicked off Barack Obama's inaugural celebration. Yet most of America didn't hear it because HBO cut off his invocation that took up the first 2.5 minutes of the concert to celebrate Obama's inauguration. He has been bishop since 2003, when he made history for becoming the first openly gay, non-celibate priest in the Episcopal Church. His election prompted a group of bishops to warn of a possible schism between the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Communion, which is the International Association of National Anglican Churches, of which the Episcopal Church is a member. In 2008, the symbolic head of that association, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, didn't invite Gene Robinson to attend the 2008 Lambeth Conference. That's the assembly of bishops of the entire Anglican Communion from around the world. It only happens every 10 years. They didn't invite him. He went anyway. In the past several years, some parishes and churches have severed their ties with the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Church of Canada. They associated themselves with the more conservative national Anglican churches and provinces that are headed mainly by African bishops. It's called an Anglican realignment. Despite all of this, and in the middle of all of this, Bishop Gene Robinson continues his efforts to bring about ecumenical and political reform for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. He was brought to Maryland by Equality Maryland yesterday to lobby in Annapolis to expand for protections for gays and lesbians. He spoke with us from Delegate Heather Meiser's office. And Bishop, it's a pleasure to meet you.
I'm delighted to be here, Mark. Thank you.
Great to have you. You look like a bishop.
Well, I'm supposed to.
Tell me what about the sojourn to Maryland and why you made it.
Actually, this is the first time that I've come to a legislative hearing in another state to assist in an effort. And partly it was due to Equality Maryland's wonderful leadership and solid planning. You know, I'm often asked 2 weeks before they want me to come, and that my schedule is crazy enough that doesn't happen. But Equality Maryland contacted me a number of months ago, and I set this up. And, you know, I've been so impressed by their work. It is really solid work, and it's bearing real fruit here in Maryland. And so I just wanted to be a part of that effort and to lend my voice in ways that might be helpful.
Now, in coming here, one of the things you just did, though, you showed me your BlackBerry, and you showed me your favorite picture from the inauguration, which is a picture of you and your lovely daughter and President Barack Obama. As we all, you've been asked about this ad nauseum, I'm sure, but you've talked a great deal about the hope you have in this administration, whether it was the invocation that you gave, which we'll talk about in a minute, and other instances. But a lot has gone on between Reverend Rick Warren speaking, the great debate over your being cut out of the HBO show about the music at the Lincoln Memorial, and then I think later put back in when I saw it, you were actually there on the rerun. But taking out of that and HBO accusing Obama's people and President Obama's people accusing HBO of the reason it happened, and the fact that people are afraid, and even in the Obama administration, to talk about gay marriage, though he mentions gays and lesbians in every speech he gives when he gives his litany of who America is. So talk about the complexity of all that and why you have so much hope in this administration.
I actually had the opportunity to get to know then-Senator Obama early on. Of course, I'm from New Hampshire. It's the first primary. And, you know, the standing joke in New Hampshire is you're asked, are you for candidate X? And the response usually is, I don't know. I've only met him five times, which must sound really strange to people from other places. But for us, what is amazing about the New Hampshire citizenry is that we take that responsibility very seriously. So, I mean, people literally go to all the candidates' websites and read all the stuff they put up and really prepare themselves to ask candidates questions. So I had the opportunity to meet him and several times. And the thing that initially drew me to his candidacy was he, in incredibly authentic and genuine ways, talked about a different way of doing politics and running this country, different than polarization. You know, I think we've had an awful long time of what I would call 51% decisions. And, of course, with any 51% decision, you may have won the vote, but you got 49% of the people who are just as happy to undermine what you've just done. And back then, of course, Hillary Clinton was the presumed candidate. And my feeling about comparing the two of them was that if you like the way the game is played in Washington, there's probably nobody better than Hillary Clinton to play and win that game. But if you want the game to change, then Barack Obama was the candidate. And so I felt cautiously optimistic, cautiously because I think changing anything as big as the federal government is hopeful at best, you know. But I really believed he had a different vision for how we might work as a country. So that this sort of an end to the kind of polarizing politics that we've seen before was what initially drew me to the campaign. And when we met early on, I wanted to talk to him, for instance, about the Millennium Development Goals that the United Nations put forward, and which the Episcopal Church has sort of adopted as part of our mission in a big sort of way. So I wanted to know, would he not only tip his hat to those goals, but talk about funding?
Could you describe those goals for a moment, just so listeners understand what
you're
talking about?
Yeah, there are eight of them, and they have to do with the empowerment of women and children, the eradication of abject poverty in the world, treatment of diseases like malaria and AIDS, and real developmental goals that aren't just feeding the hungry, although that's part of it, but doing the kind of developmental work where poor countries can support themselves. So I was drawn to his candidacy, and part of the feel of it for me was I actually thought I would never be inspired by a politician again.
You were.
But I was. I was captivated by him. And the other thing that still rings absolutely true for me, I don't know that I have met anyone so comfortable in his own skin. This is a guy who knows who he is. You know, in an interview that 60 Minutes did with the four people who managed his campaign, one of the most impressive things they said about him was that, you know, they had worked for other campaigns before, and there had always been these countless meetings about, okay, the candidate is about to meet XYZ group. So who does the candidate need to be today? And they never had those meetings with Barack Obama because he knew who he was, and he wasn't going to change that depending on who he met with. So, I mean, they literally said, we had all this extra time because we were not recrafting the candidate at every possible turn. So, I think to have someone that genuine and that comfortable in who he is, which is not to say he's going to always get it right. And consequently, when Rick Warren was invited to do the invocation, I was among those critics. And so it doesn't mean that I as a citizen or I as a gay man am going to give him carte blanche to do anything he wants. I think we owe it to him to be critical when that's necessary.
One of the things you're talking about here seems to me is, and I want to explore this a little bit with you on a couple of levels, is, I mean, A, the complexity of our political life, the complexity of this new presidency, but also the complexity of the whole world around the battle for gay and lesbian rights in this country and around the globe. Pardon me. And starting with the political end first, I mean, you just said that, and I remember that you were one of those voices who thought it was wrong, that it was a mistake to have Rick Warren as the key invocation speaker giving the prayer when he was going to be sworn in as President of the United States of America. And then again, and then you were really sheltered off to the side when it came to your role, giving your invocation at Lincoln's Memorial and when they were getting ready to have the great music fest for Barack Obama. So square those two things for me. I mean, it's one thing to say that we need to be open and inclusive in bringing all points of view in, so it's not just 51% majority, as you pointed out earlier. But then others would beg the question and say, yeah, but there's some stands you have to take. And is this indicative of something that is going to be like weak-kneed liberalism as opposed to really pushing for human and equal rights? And is this indicative of this? Is this a bad sign?
You know, I will start out by saying I've not lost any confidence in the new president, and my support for him does not waver. I think whoever made that decision simply did not think through how painful that decision to invite Rick Warren would be to gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, especially only 6 weeks after this crushing defeat in California with the passage of Proposition 8. And that was not just a crushing defeat for LGBT people in California. It was a bill for all of us. And being the kind of bellwether state California is, we were all highly invested in that campaign. And I think someone just didn't put together how painful this would be to those of us in our community. One of the things that I love about this new president and the people around him is, and I don't mean this in a condescending way, mm-hmm. they are educable. That is to say, they ask questions and they actually listen to the answers. They actually listen to the feedback they get. And when they get it wrong or it's not as right as it could be, they work to undo that. I mean, that's remarkable in a politician, if you think about it. And so although my invitation was in the works before the Rick Warren announcement, they were very clear with me that they hoped that in addition to it having already been in the works, that this would provide a measure of a comfort and a real genuine response to what they had heard from the gay community about how painful this was. And to be honest with you, I didn't see it as being shunted off to the side. There is no place I love more in Washington than the Lincoln Memorial. And I cannot go there and read Lincoln's words without weeping. And to be there where the I Have a Dream speech took place, where Marian Anderson sang at the request of Eleanor Roosevelt, and to be there with Barack Obama, I mean, my God, it doesn't get any better than that. So, you know, I was treated wonderfully by the inaugural committee and by the president-elect himself. And, you know, afterwards, you know, I got profuse apologies from the inaugural committee and from a couple of high-level executives at HBO called to apologize as well.
So why do you think that happened?
I think everyone realized that. Oh, you mean why?
Why your beginning was like they started the program officially after you gave your invocation. Why do you think that happened?
Well, what I came to believe is there's just no figuring it out. And that it wasn't worth trying. Now, I will tell you what my initial response was. What I thought was probably the case is that at some level at HBO, some entertainment person decided that nobody in America could possibly be interested in a prayer. And so that they would start the show right after that for what people really wanted, which was Bruce Springsteen and Bono and so on. I don't even think that's true, especially given the response afterwards.
Clearly, you're a very gentle and forgiving human being too, as well. It's coming loud and clear through. You're supposed to be. That's your role. But when we talk about trying to build bridges, between communities in America, one of the things you think Barack Obama is doing as President of the United States of America, I mean, as bishop in the Episcopal Church, and the uproar and the battles you've had from the moment you were mentioned as a possible bishop of the church to the schisms taking place now and people creating their own churches in the Episcopal Church because of the issue of you're being a gay man and the rest, and their views about that as being antithetical to the Bible. So let's look to the future with that. I mean, we're talking about an administration that you're saying there's trying to be more than 51%, but how do you get beyond that to a larger sense and sensibility with the public when there's so many people so rigid in their feelings, as indicative of what's known to much of the world as a progressive liberal church, being the Episcopal Church, that has caused this huge battle over you're being bishop because you're gay?
You know, I think what's true for the church is true for the LGBT movement and so on, which is that you have to be in this for the long haul. You don't turn a ship around overnight. It takes a very long time, and you have to keep your eye on the prize and not be unduly discouraged by setbacks, because no one, not Barack Obama, not me, not anyone, is always going to get it right. And the commitment has to be to hang in there with one another. The frustrating thing about what's going on, particularly in the worldwide Anglican Communion, but also in the Episcopal Church here in the United States, is we have some people who have decided they can't stay in a church where I am.
Right.
And the frustrating part is, I don't know how you make them stay. I mean, we're not leaving. I'm not going anywhere. But if they decide to leave, then I don't know how you make them stay. And it seems to me, in one sense, that's almost the one unforgivable sin, which is not to hang in there with one another. And when you think about it, that's kind of what a marriage is. It's what any relationship is. It says, okay, I'm going to love you no matter what. And we're going to have some terrible fights. But I'm going to stay committed to you. Now, sometimes that's not possible. I get that. And certainly on an interpersonal level, it's not possible. But surely the church ought to make that possible.
But even the Archbishop of Canterbury, I mean, not inviting you and having people being so nervous about this, and even your presence making the church, even the established church that might support you and not mind having a openly gay a bishop who is in a relationship with another man and not legally married in terms of the eyes of the law, that even those people who support you are kind of nervous about that, it seems. And so I'm just curious what that sets up in the church. I mean, let me start there. I have another question.
Sure. Well, you know, this was the first time, this conference of Worldwide
the
Gathering
Conference
of Bishops,
right.
The Lambeth Conference, happens every 10 years, and it's been held every 10 years since 1868. This is the first time ever that a duly elected and consecrated bishop was not invited.
Exactly.
And so, you know what? I can't do anything about him. But what I can do something about is me. And so I made the decision to go uninvited. Now, I wasn't allowed into anything, but I was not willing to let those guys meet. I don't have any trouble with the gals. They don't have any trouble with the gay issue. It's the men. I was not going to let those guys meet day after day and pretend that people like me didn't exist. People like me didn't exist in their churches. And at every opportunity, I pointed out that even in the most draconian of cultures that imprison gay and lesbian people, and in five countries, put them to death, they still have gay and lesbian people sitting in their pews no matter where they go. And so all I can do something about it is me and my own witness. And I wanted to be there to say, we're here, we're not going away. And not only that, God doesn't want me to go away. And I wanted to be a witness to the kind of joy I know in my life because of my faith and because I am absolutely certain of God's love for me. And then what they do with that is their decision.
But I wonder when you respond to them in terms of the church and just liturgically? I mean, one of the two things I was really curious about your thoughts about. I mean, A, that you look at some of the opposition to gays and lesbians and transgender people in the church comes from developing countries, comes from Africa, comes from Latin America, comes from places where people have been struggling, come out of a struggle to free themselves from the yoke of colonialism and kind of figure out a new world. And that's where a lot of the opposition comes from. Maybe not Bishop Edmund Tutu, but others, in that most of the other bishops from the continent. That's A. And B, when you look at the Bible itself, and how that fits into biblical liturgical arguments around what the Bible says, and then whose word is it that's in the Bible? Human interpretation of something higher, or the higher writing it itself? Those two things.
So on the first point about most of the opposition to the full inclusion of gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people in the church coming from developing countries in the global south. You know, first of all, it's no surprise to me that the bishops in those countries are in a different place on this because their context is so different. The reason we are in this place in the United States and in Canada and Australia and New Zealand is that so many of us have come out. And whereas 20 years ago, most people would have told you they really didn't know anyone gay or lesbian.
Right.
Oh, they might have wondered about weird Uncle Harry or those two nice ladies who've lived together forever down at the end of the street. You know, they would tell you they didn't know anyone gay, and they meant openly gay and affirming. Today, is there any family in America that doesn't know one of their family members, a coworker, a next-door neighbor, a former classmate, who's come out? So now when the issue comes up, a face comes up, and that changes everything. Because the things we used to be able to believe and say about people who were gay, we're no longer willing to say because we know it's not true of Jim or Sally or Paul. That's just not true in these countries where there are criminal penalties on the books for being gay and so on. So I'm not surprised by that. The other interesting thing that we've come to learn in the Anglican Communion is that this is also tied up with America's place in the world. A fellow at a meeting of the Anglican Communion, not a bishop, but once said something that I actually think is maybe one of the worst things ever been said about me, which was, you know, for us, there's not a lot of difference between Gene Robinson and George Bush. And I was, you know, horrified to hear that, right? But he went on to say, you know, we right now, this was before the recent election, right now, you know, we see America sort of swaggering around the world like a drunken cowboy having its way and the rest of the world be damned. And so many of them perceived my election as the Bishop of New Hampshire as just another example of America's doing what it damn well pleased without regard for anyone else. So I think there's a lot of political things, there's a lot of post-colonial things tied up with this sort of worldwide controversy. So it's not as simple, and it's not as one single issue as it may first appear. The other thing that I would say on just kind of a global scale is that what I think is happening with the LGBT movement is part of a much larger movement, which is the beginning of the end of patriarchy. And we see that played out not only in this country, but around the world. And, you know, for a very long time, straight, white, well-educated Western men made most of the decisions for the world. Then we began to let people of color come to the table. And then we let women come to the table. And we let disabled people come to the table. And oh my God, now we're letting gay and lesbian people come to the table. And the fact of the matter is, the world is never going to be the same again. Now that doesn't mean patriarchy is at an end. But I would say we might be at the beginning of the end. And so there's no surprise to me that there's horrendous resistance to that, because we're changing something that's been in place forever.
So it has been in place forever. So that's the second part of that question that I really want. Then we'll move on to something else. But that there is a battle over what the Bible means.
Yes.
For people who are Christians or Muslims or Jewish, but
sure.
We're talking about your church at the moment. Yeah. And I remember interviewing a number of years ago Dr. Gomes from Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating interview, and that was what we kind of wrestled with, was his interpretation of the Bible. But clearly, as someone, I think, one of the Comedy Central shows was saying, well, okay, if you believe in that the Bible's saying that homosexuality is an abomination, then we should also have slaves, and I should be allowed to have three or four wives.
Right. Yeah.
Talk about your interpretation of what those words in the Bible mean and where they come from and what it means for the future.
This is really the sort of basic question we're asking, and it needs to be the first question almost before you ever look at a particular passage, is how do we regard those words? And every world religion has texts that are sacred to them. But of course, for Jews and Christians, it's the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures. I would say that I believe that book to be the Word of God, but not the words of God.
That's interesting.
I don't believe that those words were dictated by God or even God's emissaries. I do believe that it is the best and finest and holiest record we have of people who have known God and their perceptions of God as recorded there. So, you know, in the Hebrew scriptures, we have some perceptions of a God which early on was perceived to be just Israel's God. And they were the chosen people, and Yahweh was their God. There were many gods in the world.
Right.
And you have all these wonderful stories in the Hebrew scriptures about, you know, my God is my God can beat up your God.
Right.
And you have these contests and so on. Right about the time of Isaiah, maybe in the sort of 500, 600 BC, all of a sudden Israel begins to believe that their God might be God and not just their God. So you have this development of God as really God of the universe. And then the Christians pick that up with believing that Jesus was this sort of perfect and most complete revelation of God. What's happened is, you know, the Bible is always meant to point to God, who can never be totally knowable, can never be put into any kind of a box. And instead, we've put the Bible up on a shelf and almost begun to worship it rather than the reality to which it points. And so we have made, I would say, in some ways, an idol of the Bible. So, do I take the Bible seriously? Absolutely. Is it where we start? Absolutely. And do I believe it is the Word of God? Yes. But this is the essential part. I don't believe God stopped revealing God's self at the end of the first century when the canon or the collection of books that we now know as the Bible was settled. Otherwise, God could have just walked away and said, okay, I've told you everything you need to know. Have a great time. Good luck with it. I'm off to the Bahamas for a vacation, you know. But instead, I mean, there's this amazing passage in John's Gospel at the Last Supper. Jesus says to the disciples an astounding thing. He says, there is more that I would teach you, but you cannot bear it right now. So I will send the Holy Spirit, who will lead you into all truth. Now, I take that to mean he's saying, okay, you know, for a bunch of fishermen, you guys have really done a great job, and you've changed a lot, and you've learned a lot. But don't you for a minute think that God is finished with you and God is not done teaching you stuff. And that's what God's Holy Spirit is going to do. He's going to lead you into all truth. I think that Spirit led us into a greater truth about people of color, about women, and now I think that Spirit is leading us to a different place about gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people.
So here we are in 2009, and the world for gay, lesbian, transgender people has changed mightily.
Yes.
especially in the West, but I think throughout the world. You had your own sojourn as someone who struggled with their sexuality as a very young man. And from what I read about you, being very open with the woman that you married, even before you married her, about your own questions about your mm-hmm. sexuality and who you were. And you fell in love with this woman. You had two children.
Two wonderful children.
The one daughter I saw in that picture looks lovely.
They
look very happy together. That you became clear that you could not remain in a heterosexual marriage. You parted as friends. You still love each other and are very close from what I've read.
Yeah, I talked to her yesterday.
Okay. And you're in a relationship with a man now. So I lead all that to say, just to give a sense of your history to our listeners, but to ask you what your understanding of human sexuality is. I mean it this way. You clearly were somebody who fell in love with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known people who, one of my dearest old friends, a former lover of mine, a woman, left another man she was with and fell in love with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been in a relationship now for 10 years. And I said, we started this conversation about it one night, and she said, well, no, I'm not a lesbian. I just fell in love with a woman. And there are some cultures in the world, a few Native American cultures like the Lakota and a couple others, that believe in Wintes and people who have a different sexuality to be respected. There's a third way in some Buddhist cultures in Southeast Asia. There's a few cultures that actually respond to that. So I wonder what your, and I set that all up to ask you what you think humankind is sexually.
Mm-hmm.
Are we pansexual? Pardon me, are we homosexual? Are we heterosexual? Are we something in between? Is it something so complex because of the oppression of our sexuality over the millenniums in different cultures that we haven't really figured that out yet? So talk about what you think sexuality is in this world.
Well, first of all, congratulations, because I almost never get asked about bisexuality, and there's so much misinformation out there, especially amongst Christian people or anyone who argues for monogamy. Because so many people hear the word bisexual and they make the equation to someone who's having sex with both the opposite and same-sex partners at the same time,
right.
Which is, not, I mean, when two heterosexual people get married, you know, the man makes a commitment not to have sex with all the other women in the world, right? So it's no different than that.
Right.
So a bisexual person is someone who is not particularly drawn to one or the other sex in terms of intimacy and life partners. Now, I'm sometimes asked, am I bisexual? Since I was married to a woman, I have two children, so on and so forth. And I don't define myself that way, because if something happened to my partner of 20 years, I would not be looking just for a relationship. And that it wouldn't matter to me whether it was a man or a woman.
You're looking for a man.
I would only be looking for a man.
Okay.
So I define myself as a gay man. If I were bisexual, I would be looking for a partner and intimacy, and actually the gender would not matter to me. But here's where I think to your larger question about who are we as humankind. I think we're in a very interesting moment right now. You know, it used to be gay and straight. Then it was gay and lesbian and straight. And then it was gay and lesbian and bisexual and straight. And now we've added transgender. And, you know, we're going to run out of letters pretty soon. There just aren't enough letters to describe all the sexualities that we are.
That's right.
And the fact of the matter is, I think there are as many sexualities, plural, as there are human beings. I mean, take a room full of straight people. Different things turn them on. Different things turn them off. Some like long hair. Some people love bald-headed people. The range is unbelievable. Some were abused as children. Some were not. Some have had really positive experiences. Some have had some horrific experiences. So when it comes down to it, each one of us is a unique sexuality. And ultimately, I think that's where we're headed, which is to say that with certain serious caveats, like we don't take advantage of the young or the disabled, disabled mentally. Relationships need to be mutual and so on and so forth. Within those parameters, I think each one of us is his or her own sexuality. And wouldn't it be terrific if we got to a place that we could affirm everyone in their sexuality, in their responsible acting out of their sexuality?
So here you are in Maryland, in Delegate Heather Meiser's office.
She may be horrified that we're doing this in her office.
We're just talking.
Okay, there we go. That's right. Yes, yes, all you listeners out there, we're only talking.
What? And Heather is openly a lesbian in the House of Delegates. And you were here for Equality Maryland.
Yes.
And we just had this kind of anthropophilosophical discussion for a minute about what sexuality is in the world and talking about your own sojourn. But if you could take that into the realm of our day-to-day politics, which is where we are now. And to have that discussion is part of the discussion, but how do you take that sensibility and translate that into the politics of the 21st century, where here in Maryland we are fighting over the issue of gay marriage and complete rights for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender people in the state of Maryland. So everybody's not going to agree with this idea you have, or that I may have, of what sexuality is for human beings. But there is a very concrete thing to deal with in terms of the legal rights.
Yes.
I mean, making that bridge, which
yes.
is not an easy bridge to cross, obviously, because people of goodwill who I've interviewed who believe in rights of all people have a real hard time making the emotional, cultural transfer to marriage and other issues like that.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Let me just point out that this is nothing new. If we had waited for everyone to feel comfortable with full civil rights for black people, we probably would still have Jim Crow laws on the books. What the Supreme Court did and what the National Congress did was to do the right thing. And we're still living into the reality of that. And the right thing was to make the promises of both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution a reality. That we are all created equal, that we all deserve life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And we have a Constitution that guarantees equal protection under the law for all citizens. So we moved on that before, I would even maintain, before a majority agreed with it. But we did it because it was the right thing. Feeling comfortable with this change is not the criteria. The criteria is, does the Constitution mean what it says in terms of equal protection and equal treatment under the law? Now, this, I would maintain, has gotten very confused for us around marriage in particular, but between religion and the state. That is to say, in this country, clergy have been asked to act as agents of the state in enacting marriages. But what makes it a marriage is the signature on the marriage license. And if you have any doubt about that, think of what somebody who wants to dissolve a marriage does. They don't go back to the church or synagogue. They go to the court. It was the state that made it a marriage, and it is the state that undoes a marriage. Now, in some countries, like France, everyone gets married at the mayor's office, and then religious people go to their place of worship and get a blessing on that. And that's where I think we need to move here. But at any rate, we need to separate what the state does from what the church does. You go to a wedding today, and most people couldn't tell you where the civil action ends and the religious part begins. It's gotten very confused. So the question is not, does my religion approve of this? I'm not arguing for anyone's, except in my own church, arguing for anyone's religion to approve this. I'm making a secular argument to the secular civil state that it needs to live up to the promise of the Constitution, and that marriage and the protections and the responsibilities that come with marriage are a right that should be available to all of our citizens. Then denominations and faiths of many kinds can take as long as they want to decide whether or not they want to add their blessing to that marriage. But in the meantime, can we agree that all of us deserve that kind of equal protection under the law?
You've been listening to my conversation with the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, the openly gay Episcopalian Bishop of New Hampshire. Please don't go away, because right after this break, we'll continue our conversation. And don't forget, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people out during the Great Depression. Over the last 70 years, they're still here to help people during difficult times. For more information, go to MECU.com, and we'll be right back. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. I'm speaking this hour with the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, the ninth bishop of the Diocese of New Hampshire in the Episcopal Church of the United States. He made history in 2003 as the first openly gay man to be made bishop in the Episcopal Church. His election immediately became a point of controversy and divisiveness inside that church, and was one of the events that caused the Anglican realignment, or the decision of some traditional Anglican Episcopalian churches to break ties with the Mother Episcopal Church in favor of associating with more conservative Anglican groups. Bishop Robinson was in Annapolis yesterday to speak to our General Assembly, and was kind enough to spend some time with us speaking about his sojourn. But I had some more questions, so earlier today I caught up with him by phone for a little chat, a little bit more. So enjoy. Bishop Gene Robinson, welcome. Good to have you back with us within 24 hours.
It's great to be back.
So I thought a lot about our conversation. And one of the things that really struck me when we talked about the Lambeth Conference, where you were denied an invitation by Archbishop Rowan, and you went anyway. And I watched your demeanor as you talked about your life and about gay and lesbian issues, about spirituality, about the Episcopal Church that people just heard you talk about on this program, and couldn't help but think, but how did Gene Robinson, the man, feel about that ostracism inside the church, being treated as a spiritual leper in some sense, when you weren't? You had your supporters, but I'm just curious, what did you go through?
Well, to be honest, that experience turned out to be far more difficult than I had anticipated. I felt ready for it. I felt spiritually prepared. But as it turned out, it was very much more painful than I anticipated. And it's very difficult to be treated poorly, but it's even more difficult to be treated poorly by those you consider to be your brothers and sisters in Christ. So that in and of itself is hard. It was very difficult because I was denied any credential to go anywhere where the bishops were. I was actually cut off from my brother and sister bishops in the American House of Bishops. And so that was very, very difficult. But there were several things that sort of got me through and sort of kept me focused. One of them was I had received an invitation from a place called Greyfriars. It's the Franciscan house in Canterbury, which has been there since the year 1224, which is kind of an astounding number
Yes.
to Americans. And in fact, I think the original head of the household was, I don't know, the uncle or nephew of Thomas Becket. I mean, it goes back that far. Mm. And they invited me to come there. I went there almost the first day I arrived and was welcomed with such open arms. And I was invited to do a very special thing, which was to pray with the four brothers there every morning at 7 o'clock. And so we were staying outside of Canterbury for security reasons. And so, you know, we would leave there at 6:30 in the morning and arrive in the middle of this little oasis in the middle of Canterbury and go and worship in a chapel that sat above a rushing stream with an acre of wildflowers outside and quietly pray the prayers with the brothers. It just focused me and helped me on a daily basis remember why I was there and that I belonged to God, and no matter what happened for the rest of the day, that was secure. So that really helped. And, you know, I am just so committed to reconciliation. I learned a long time ago to not take this kind of treatment so terribly personally. And it may sound condescending or patronizing, and I don't mean it to be that way, but every time someone hates me, I try to remind myself that hatred, that behavior, is coming from a place of fear. And so instead of taking it personally, what I try to ask myself is, what is it that's making this person so afraid? And then do what I can to ease those fears. And then just let it be what it is, and not demand that it be something else. And, you know, when I was going through my consent process, someone gave me a little piece of calligraphy, which has really become my mantra. And it says, sometimes God calms the storm, but sometimes God lets the storm rage and calms his child. And that's how I do this. I let the storm rage. And then I let God, by God's grace, bring me to that very, very still place in the eye of the storm. And that's where I try to live my life.
I mean, it's obvious, Bishop Robinson, that you are a deeply, deeply spiritual being. I could just tell that sitting across from you and when we were together yesterday. And I wonder what happens to you when you sit across the table, and maybe even at that moment in Lambeth, or looked into the eyes of your fellow bishops, maybe men and women who might support who you are, but were there anyway, and those who reviled you despite all the rumors, even about their own sexuality being questioned, and what you felt from those men and women across from you.
You know, I find that experience be one of the most enlivening and encouraging of all. And I always find those moments to be wonderful because whenever we meet face-to-face like that, what inevitably happens is that we discover that we have far more in common than that which separates us. What is way more difficult and what is ultimately the most discouraging is when someone refuses to sit at the table with me. And I have to tell you that is the most painful thing that happens to me in my life is that I don't get a chance to sit across the table from those folks. Because when I do that, then there's always hope. But if a person refuses to meet me face to face, I don't know what to do with that. I can't make someone do that, and it's only in those moments that I feel hopeless because the person is not willing to open themselves to what might happen.
And I you also seem to be, it puts you in a position to be not unlike somebody who is was the first African American or first woman to take a position of note in any given field, you wind up being pushed to be the gay bishop instead of the bishop by some.
Yeah, you know, early on, I said often that I didn't want to be the gay bishop. I just wanted to be the good bishop.
Right.
Or a good bishop. But, you know, in the last 5.5 years, I've kind of made my peace with the gay bishop thing, in the sense that I've come to discern, and I think my diocese has as well, that maybe being the gay bishop is the part of the ministry that I'm called to right now. It's not what I was looking for, but maybe it is what God had in mind, at least for part of my ministry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I fully expected there would be others that coming along right soon after me. I never expected that for, you know, 5.5, 6 years, I would still be the only one. And so I've come to believe that for good or ill or whatever I'm able to do or not, it is a part of what I've been called to do at this particular moment in time. So I've come to it reluctantly in some ways, and where I've turned my thoughts now is I want to be a good steward of that opportunity. If I'm going to be the gay bishop, then I want to be the best gay bishop that I can be, and allow God to use me in whatever ways God sees fit.
And I don't want to to explore this too deeply. We only have a few minutes left, but when you talked about the transition you made and leaving your wife and becoming and being open with who you really are, I think that there are a lot of people who in the straight world have no understanding of what that is like. To finally come to grips and let yourself be who you are.
I think the gay or lesbian person experience of coming out is the same experience, perhaps writ large, but the same experience that almost anyone has when they have something about themselves that they feel if the world came to know that they would be completely and utterly unacceptable. I think we all fear not being loved, and there are things about us that we're fearful that if people find that thing out, that we won't be loved. Compounded, of course, for gay and lesbian people, because even our parents, who are supposed to love us no matter what, are perhaps the people we fear losing the most if we come out as gay or lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. And so this experience of laying claim to, not being ashamed of, even being proud of who you are, when that thing has been that which you feared the most would cut you off from everyone, your family and friends, from your career and from your whole life. And so I think it is hard for people to understand what a huge thing this is for us. And yet as long as the culture continues to be this negative about us, we are putting countless young people, teenagers, young adults, through the most unbelievable pain because they don't know whether they will be loved by their families and friends.
Bishop Gene Robinson, I just can say one more time, it's been an honor and a pleasure to have met you and to have you on this program and to meet such a deeply spiritual human being doing what you do. And thank you so much.
Thank you so much, and I really, really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to my conversation with the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, the ninth bishop of the Diocese of New Hampshire in the Episcopal Church of the United States, and the first gay Episcopalian bishop. If you missed part of the show, please visit us online at www.steinershow.org to stream or podcast. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite hits the road with an issue of travel stories, from regional day journeys to journeys back in time. Urbanite is available for pickup at over 800 locations region-wide and online at www.urbanitebaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media and is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Christina Arison and Judith Lloyd. Our theme music is by Warr Matthews of Clean Cuts. And thanks to Nick Sjostrom for helping engineers today at Clean Cuts. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner, and take care.